From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. And it was politics as usual for President Trump at a rally in Dallas last night. He slammed Democrats as they pursue their impeachment inquiry.
Radical Democrats have been trying to overthrow the results of a great, great election. Maybe, maybe the greatest election in the history of our country.
And today, the White House is in damage control mode after Acting Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney had to walk back his admission that there was indeed a quid pro quo in Ukraine to extract politically motivated investigations involving Democrats. It is time for our Friday Politics Roundtable. Let's bring in Tolu Olorunipua. He's a White House reporter for The Washington Post. Hi, Tolu.
Hi there.
And Beth Fooey, senior politics editor at NBC. Beth, good to speak with you.
Thank you.
And Beth, let's start with you. Here's Mick Mulvaney yesterday in that startling press briefing. He's being questioned by ABC's John Carl about what the president wanted in Ukraine.
So the demand for an investigation into the Democrats was part of the reason that he ordered to withhold funding to Ukraine.
The look back to what happened in 2016 certainly was part of the thing that he was worried about in corruption with that nation. And that is absolutely appropriate.
Withholding the funding.
Yeah.
So, Beth, how much of a problem did Mick Mulvaney just create for the White House?
Well, the thing about this White House is that so many people from President Trump on down will just sort of say what typically you would think are thoughts or words that would be hidden or would not be disclosed publicly in front of the press. And here's another example of Mick Mulvaney actually doing that, just saying right out there with all the certainty and confidence in the world that a quid pro quo had been conducted in this situation, which, of course, you know, flies in the face of what President Trump and others around him have tried to deny that there was any sort of exchange of political favors for the military money going to Ukraine. It was a really eye-popping moment. Mr. Mulvaney was so confident and so comfortable in what he was saying. I think reporters were just completely caught off guard that this
get
was
over
going
it,
to be disclosed
said.
This way. Yeah, he yeah. said, get over it. This is done all the time, that politics in exchange for foreign policy is the norm in White Houses. Now, of course, as you said, he's had to walk it back. Apparently, President Trump not happy with how Mr. Mulvaney conducted himself. But then he, of course, threw it back on the press and said that the press had misconstrued what he said, even though it was right there on live TV for all to see.
Yeah, definitely an eye-popping moment, which really begs the question if this reversal is really credible after he so clearly stated this was a quid pro quo. Tolu, your thoughts on this?
Yeah, not too many people are buying the walk back, in part because he had many opportunities during this press conference. I was there in the White House press briefing room yesterday, and several reporters asked him with follow-ups several times to basically confirm what he was saying, and he continued to confirm that, yes, there was a quid pro quo, and he thought it was appropriate. It happens all the time. So I do think that there were several hours in which he saw the responses come in, not only within the West Wing, where people were really taken aback by the comments that he made, but also across Capitol Hill. Several Republican lawmakers spoke out and said that they were not comfortable with what the acting chief of staff said and how he contradicted the president's denials of a quid pro quo. So several hours later, we do see the walk back, but it does have credibility issues because people are wondering why it took so long to clarify and why he didn't clarify in the moment when he had multiple opportunities to do so in the room.
Tolu, I want to ask you about a story the Post put out this morning about George Kent's testimony earlier this week. The Deputy Assistant Secretary of State testified that he'd raised concerns back in 2015 about Vice President Biden's son serving on the board of this Ukrainian gas company. He then said that it was brushed off by a Biden staffer. What else can you tell us about what we learned from Ken's testimony there on that issue?
Yeah, that testimony is giving some fodder to Republicans and to the president's presidential campaign as they try to make Hunter Biden a central issue in the campaign. You've heard several times reporters and folks who have looked at this say that there was nothing that has been substantiated. But this testimony behind closed doors by George Kent shows that there was at least some angst within the State Department, some concern that Hunter Biden being on the board of this Ukrainian gas company at the same time that his father, the vice president, was the point person in the Obama administration for Ukraine policy. It did not present the right public view when it comes to corruption, when it comes to impropriety, that it you know, was not above board in terms of the optics. And this diplomat said that he tried to raise this concern, but he was brushed off by the vice president's office. So that does sort of add to some of the arguments that are being made by Republicans and by the president's campaign that what was happening with Hunter Biden back in 2015 was not above board and that there needs to be an investigation to look further into it.
Right. And there's still no evidence of any wrongdoing by any of the Bidens. But as you said, Republicans will likely use this in their defense of the president. Beth, I want to ask you a little bit about the depositions. Next week, acting Ukraine Ambassador William Taylor is scheduled to go under deposition, and he'll be asked about a text he sent to the EU Ambassador Gordon Sondland, in which he wrote that he thought it was crazy to withhold military aid to Ukraine for help with a political campaign. What is your sense of what lies ahead? Are there going to be any more bombshells, you think?
Well, I think what's significant is that we saw several career diplomats come forward this weekend and, you know, a political appointed diplomat, Bill Sondland, yesterday, but then several more next week as well. And what that says to me is, despite the fact that President Trump and others in the administration are refusing to cooperate with the Hill's investigation and calling it, you know, going so far as to call it a kangaroo court, that kind of thing, many of these diplomats are coming forward on their own volition. They are going to go ahead and say what they know. Tell their story, despite the pushback from the White House around this whole investigation. What it says to me is that they see a career ahead of them that is not necessarily tied to this president, and they do not want to compromise their own reputation, their own professional integrity to protect him. They would, you know, just as soon step forward and tell what they know and keep their credibility.
Look, the other big story we've been following, of course, is Syria and Turkey's incursion into northern Syria against the Kurds. On the Senate floor yesterday, Utah Republican Mitt Romney said this about the ceasefire that the Trump administration announced yesterday after the president pulled U.S. troops out of Syria and then Turkey invaded.
I note in closing that I also hope the ceasefire agreement is honored and that Turkey ends its brutal killing. But I note that lives are already lost and American honor has already been tarnished. We once abandoned a red line. Now we abandon an ally.
Tolu, strong words from Mitt Romney, but that is common for him. The president has brushed off all of this criticism, including that of Republican ally Lindsey Graham, who said the pullout was the biggest mistake of Trump's presidency. Where do we stand on this? How much is this controversy distracting and damaging the president?
There was a vote earlier this week in which the large majority of Republicans in the House voted to repudiate the president on this. They voted with the unanimous support of the Democrats, but it was a bipartisan vote that showed that Congress, lawmakers, Republicans, and Democrats are not happy with President Trump's Syria policy, even now that the administration has put forward what they say is a ceasefire and what the Turks are calling a pause. Turkey received a lot of the benefit from this deal because they are getting basically what they wanted from this incursion. They're getting extra territory that they have taken from the Kurds, and it's not even clear that this ceasefire is holding up. So Republicans and Democrats are going to continue to push. They're looking at sanctions on Turkey. This is going to continue to be an issue that causes some consternation within the Trump administration, that his foreign policy is being rejected so much by lawmakers on both sides of the aisle.
Yeah. Beth, so as you said, Tolu, I mean, Turkey got exactly what it wants. Is there any way, Beth, that you see that the president can call any part of this a victory?
Well, he did last night when the
I mean,
the
he
news
did,
this...
but parts of it, yes. What Look, about it can he call a victory?
Well, you know, President Trump is nothing but a master brander, and he's going to brand this a success no matter what. But, you know, as Tolu is rightly saying, the Republicans who have been so reluctant to break with this president around just about anything up until this point are really sort of stepping away from him on this. I mean, of course, you know, 60 Republicans did stick with him on that bipartisan vote, but 120 voted against the president. So President Trump is clearly seeing seeing that this is not going to be the same situation as with other matters during his presidency, that the Republicans are going to sort of step back, not say anything, or praise the president. They are clearly willing to break with him here. It's different, though, than breaking with him around the Ukraine and impeachment. That would be perhaps a bridge too far for most of these Republicans. So being able to break with him on foreign policy is perhaps less risky to them politically than stepping into the president's shadow around impeachment.
We have less than a minute here, so I just want to quickly ask both of you, related to 2020 and the election, what headlines stood out to you? Tolu.
Well, I would say that the fact that the president is continuing to campaign, continuing to ratchet up his rhetoric, saying that Democrats do not even love the country, I think that's a through line that we should be watching very closely. He is clearly put off by this impeachment, and he's going to go full Trump when it comes to attacking his opponents.
Beth, you got about 15 seconds.
Well, it seems like a million years ago, but there was a Democratic debate this week, nationally televised, and I think we saw a change in the dynamic there. Elizabeth Warren, who'd been on the ascent as the front runner, really came under fire from her opponents. We were seeing a shift in the dynamic in that field.
That's Beth Fooey at NBC and Tolu Olorunipal from The Washington Post. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
This message comes from NPR sponsor MindBody. MindBody connects millions to the widest variety of local fitness classes, and they offer the same experience when it comes to massage and acupuncture, spas and salons. Find, book, and pay all in one place. Owners can join the network at mindbodyonline.com/NPR. MindBody, your access to the largest consumer wellness network and marketplace.
At Tuesday's Democratic presidential debate, Senator Elizabeth Warren floated an idea, one that allows workers at big companies to elect members to the corporate board.
That'll make a difference when a corporation decides, gee, we could save a nickel by moving a job to Mexico, when there are people on the board in the boardroom saying, no, do you know what that does to our company? Do you know what that does to our community, to what it does to our workers?
There is a name for this in economics. It's called co-determination, and the Germans have been doing it for a long time. Simon Jaeger is an economist at MIT. Simon, welcome.
Thanks for having me on your program, Peter. I'm delighted to be here.
Sure, and Warren's plan would allow employees to elect 40% of a company's board. They'd go even further in Germany, where it's 50% for big corporations. How did the Germans come to this idea?
Yeah, so it's an idea that has a long tradition in Germany. So the Germans have had this type of institution for about 70 years. And it's actually the case that in medium-sized firms, so up to 2,000 employees, workers elect a third of the directors. And in large firms, it's actually 50%. But interestingly, often the decisions that these boards take are unanimous. So the workers and the shareholders' representatives negotiate until there's a compromise.
And Germany is one of the biggest capitalist countries in the world. It sounds like you're saying it's working out for them, okay?
Well, so originally the idea behind it was to empower workers, to give them voice and to give them responsibility. And the economic argument behind it is essentially twofold. So one, people have hypothesized that giving workers a seat on the board could lead to more cooperative relations between the firm's management and its workforce, so that workers and management conceive of each other as what the Germans call social partners. Hmm. And second, workers might have important information about what's going on at the shop floor level, how to improve production or issues that are bothering them, including outsourcing. And that type of information may get lost in firms with deep hierarchies and multiple levels of management.
And is it much different than having a union?
It is very different because the workers here are directly elected to the corporate board. So once they are on the corporate board, they are co-equals with the other kind of the shareholder-elected directors, and they then see the books, and they are involved in decision-making, and, you know, they need to build majorities on the board. So it is a more cooperative institution rather than kind of like a firm head-to-head negotiating with a union.
Huh. So if Elizabeth Warren is elected as president, she wants to bring this to the United States. But, you know, the culture of the U.S. is different than Germany, even though they're both big capitalist countries. Do you see the idea of co-determination working here? This is a country where workers, frankly, don't enjoy as much power.
Well, it's hard for me to predict what would happen in the U.S., But I can tell you what we found based on our own research in Germany. And we actually found that firms that have to have workers on the board, and this is research with my colleagues at UC Berkeley, Benjamin Schofer, and Jörg Heining at IAB in Nuremberg, we found that these firms invest more and labor becomes more productive. Now I can say, well, perhaps this is something that only works in Germany because, you know, relationships between labor and capital are perhaps more cooperative. But what our evidence is consistent with is this might not be an institution that gives labor so much power at the end of the day. So suppose that worker representatives on the board pushed for incredibly high wages. In that case, the shareholder representatives in these large companies could still just outvote them, right? So in order to wield influence, the worker-elected directors need to build coalitions and compromise with the shareholders and propose solutions that work for both sides. It's always hard to predict what will happen in other countries, you know, where this hasn't been tried before. But I do think that it has the potential to be an institution that leads to more cooperative labor relations in other labor markets as well.
So what are the drawbacks? Because business owners and executives might say that giving workers so much say over corporate decision making might damage the company's competitiveness, especially in a world where other countries may not have the same policies.
That's exactly right. So I think you get at the main criticism that has been raised about this institution. The workers will push for higher salaries. They'll make it harder to run these firms, and that will drive up labor costs. And that, in turn, will lead to shareholders wanting to inject fewer funds into these firms and actually, you know, investing less and kind of like these firms atrophying. Now, what we found in our research is that actually we don't find evidence for higher wages. Rather, we found that these companies produce more in-house and actually become more productive. So labor becomes more productive because workers have more machines and so on around. But we don't find effects on negative effects on productivity, for example.
That's Simon Yeager, professor of economics at MIT. Simon, thanks so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Peter. It was a pleasure.
Amazon premieres the show Modern Love today, based on the New York Times column by the same name. This is different than the WBUR-produced podcast Modern Love, also based on the column. This new show is an anthology series with appearances from actors like Tina Fey and Anne Hathaway. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans joins us now with more on what we can expect on the show. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
So, true to form, this show explores all kinds of love, and it's based on real stories from people who write into the column, but I imagine there's a different texture here because what we're seeing are stories that are coming to life through scenes and acting.
Yeah, it's fictionalized. So I actually saw a critic describe it in a really interesting way. He called it Black Mirror for rom-coms. So it's like, if you know that anthology series from Netflix, it's these bite-sized stories where an entire world is created over the course of the episode, and there's some kind of poignant, unexpected development within the storytelling. And that's what makes it so enjoyable, in addition to the fact that they got some pretty big names to do this.
Yeah, let's talk about the first episode. It's about a single woman who gets pregnant and realizes the person she's closest to in life is actually her apartment's doorman. Here he is giving her advice.
No one is going to judge you. Do what you wish, but don't do it because you're scared. You must own your actions in life.
I can't do this on my own.
The village brings up a child, and New York is a very great village. Now get some good sleep. Tomorrow's a brand new day that's never been touched.
Okay, this is a strong bond between two very unlikely people, but it's not like what we see in a rom-com, as you mentioned. How does the show highlight these less dramatic connections?
Well, you know, I wouldn't say every story is about less dramatic connections, but any New Yorker who's lived in a building with a doorman will recognize the interesting relationship you can have with the person who has that job. The flavor of the city comes through a lot of these stories, but sometimes they can be very dramatic. You know, Anne Hathaway stars in an episode about a woman who is bipolar. Mm. And that's a very dramatic story, and it allows her to really showcase her acting talents. And so there are poignant stories about the unusual ways of connection that often happen in a big city like New York City.
Yeah, one of the later episodes actually tells the story of a gay couple whose desire to adopt a child leads them to take in a pregnant homeless woman. Here she is after saying the couple can actually have her baby.
So are we doing this?
Wait, don't you want to know if we, like, own our apartment or how much we take home a year, what colleges we went to?
Are we on a contract? That's a popular one.
No. No, I don't care about any of that stuff. I just want to see that you're in love. I think you are.
Well, it's not always happy families with us. It frequently descends into Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
Sure.
And Eric, this is really the kind of unusual situation Modern Love, the column, has always featured, that people have always loved about it. Do you think this show does a good job bringing that diversity that the column and the podcast has always had to the screen?
Yeah, I'm not a huge consumer of the podcast or the column, but I will say that the episodes that I saw did do an interesting job with that. But I didn't see women of color get a very prominent role in many of these episodes. And so that's something that I would like to have seen, you know, a little bit more of. But, you know, there are lots of male actors of color. And as you mentioned, there's a lot of different kinds of love depicted. So yeah. There's one about a married couple that have been together for a long time. And basically, they have to learn to fall in love with each other again. You mentioned the episode where it's really about a love story between a woman and her doorman in an odd way. He's a father for her in a way that her actual father doesn't seem to be. So there's a lot of different kinds of love and romantic relationships depicted in the series. And again, that's what makes it so interesting, and that's what makes it so different, is that you're seeing a look at a lot of different kinds of love.
Yeah, these stories are not tied up neatly in a bow. It really shows the complexity of romantic relationships. But before we leave you, we have to ask you about another show that you've been watching. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Sure. It's airing on Showtime. It's called Back to Life. It's about a woman who was convicted of murder and served 18 years in jail. And then she tries to come back to her life in a small village in England.
Ooh.
And that sounds very serious, but it's actually a dark comedy that fans of Fleabag will recognize that style and tone.
Okay, I know what I'll be doing this weekend then. Thank you. That's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Eric, thank you very much.
Thank you.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Before Ukraine's new president traveled to the United Nations last month and met with President Trump, many Ukrainians hoped the U.S. would play a more active role in ending their country's 5-year conflict with Russia. But now, after the whistleblower report and impeachment inquiry, Ukraine stands more isolated than before. NPR's Lucian Kim reports from the Ukrainian capital of Kyiv.
When Donald Trump held his first meeting with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in New York last month, many Ukrainians were surprised by one offhand remark by the U.S. president.
I really hope that you and President Putin get together and can solve your problem. That would be a tremendous achievement.
Zelensky's problem with Vladimir Putin that Trump was referring to is a Russian-backed insurgency in eastern Ukraine that has cost the lives of more than 13,000 people. In just a couple of sentences, Trump seemed to say that Ukraine could not count on his help in making peace with Putin. And now, with Washington distracted by the impeachment inquiry, Zelensky is being left largely to his own devices in the first big test of his presidency. fulfilling a campaign promise to end the grinding low-level war in eastern Ukraine. Alyona Getmanchuk, director of the New Europe Center in Kiev, says Ukrainians have stopped seeing Trump as an ally.
I would say that Ukraine is becoming more and more isolated after Zelensky's visit to New York. We think that we cannot count on the U.S. anymore in our peace negotiations with Russia.
The top U.S. diplomats working in Kiev are gone, casualties of Trump's attempt to get Ukraine to investigate one of his chief political rivals, former Vice President Joe Biden.
I believe that the major problem for bilateral relations is this lack of clarity as to the intentions of the United States administration.
Konstantin Grishenko is a former Ukrainian foreign minister and ambassador to Washington.
The attention will be not on what Ukraine needs, but what one can get out of Ukraine for purely political ends.
But the U.S. is not the only friendly country losing interest in Ukraine. During a recent press conference in Kiev, Zelensky acknowledged that Ukraine's main partners in Europe are also getting tired of helping out. Zelensky said he understands there is a growing desire in Europe to end economic sanctions on Russia, which were imposed 5 years ago to punish Putin for his seizure of Ukrainian territory. Zelensky said his priority is ending the conflict in eastern Ukraine, and he says Ukraine will never regain control over its borders without negotiating with Moscow. That's an idea some Ukrainians find hard to accept. Zelensky is treading a dangerous path, and before his trip to New York, he'd been hoping for U.S. support in dealing with Putin. Natalia Gumenyuk, head of the Hromadske TV station, says that's not going to happen. But Zelensky's position is not as weak as it might appear.
Despite the fact he's alone without this strong support of the West, he has leverage and credibility because he has been elected with such a huge support. I think even in the eyes of Putin, this popularity matters a lot.
As long as he retains the support of the people, she says, Zelensky still has a chance to bring peace to Ukraine. Lucian Kim, NPR News, Kyiv.
There are reports of shelling and artillery fire in northern Syria today, signs that the five-day ceasefire between the Turkish military and the Kurds is already faltering. This violence is the latest chapter in an eight-year civil war in Syria. You may remember back in 2018 when the Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad launched a relentless bombing campaign against an enclave of anti-government fighters in the area of eastern Ghouta. He's accused of dropping chemical bombs on his own civilians. That sound of a mother wailing over her son's body is the same in any language, and it's from a new National Geographic documentary called The Cave. Syrian filmmaker Faris Fayad tells the story of a group of doctors and nurses working in an underground hospital in eastern Ghouta. Fayad was nominated for an Academy Award for his 2017 documentary, Last Men in Aleppo, and he's here with us now. Faris, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me and give me the space to express and tell the story.
And what a place you've taken us to. This underground hospital, it's called The Cave. How did it come to be? Just a few miles outside of Damascus.
Yeah, exactly. Damascus is like Manhattan, then Eastern Ghouta is Brooklyn. Like this, exactly the distance. And in 2013, the Syrian Medical Society started to move the whole hospital underground because the heavy bomb by the Russian and the Syrian regime warplane that start to attack the hospital facilities, mostly in Eastern Ghouta, because the city was sieged completely for almost six years. And this is what I try to bring into the story.
And so life moved underground. It wasn't just the hospitals. It was like daily life in Eastern Ghouta. It went underground. Because why? Because it was just so incredibly dangerous to be above ground?
Exactly. Completely the life move underground. And the cave is not just a hospital. It's a space for refugees, space for people who are living there, for a relationship that growing up in this space to put the people in the situation and the feeling of the Syrian war.
Well, the heroes of your film are the hospital staff that work at this underground hospital, especially the woman who runs it, Dr. Amani Balour. She's a pediatrician, and it comes as a shock to many of the patients who meet her that she is the one in charge of this hospital. Tell me about that.
Exactly. In the history of Syria, she's the first woman to manage an hospital. And Amani was not just an ordinary doctor trying to save the life of these people, but also try to change the society and try to put the woman in equal way next to the man for the future of Syria, and also teaching the little girls who was like never have opportunities to speak and talk and having a conversation. They give them, like, through the storytelling, through the line of the story, you can see how the children have the space to speak. And the cave turned to be a place where turned to be like a kind of democracy system for this woman to find themselves.
The conditions they work in are just terrible. They have very little medicine. They have no anesthesia for operations. There's very little food. The power is unreliable at best. And then they also have to deal with this. Let's listen. That is the sound of Russian warplanes that are a constant threat in this film overhead. How did the doctors and the staff carry on in conditions like this?
We was asking ourselves when we was shooting me and my cinematographer all the time how Dr. Amani can handle this with her team, because the sound is powerful in a way, in like a horror movie. Like, I can't put it for the American audience, if they saw the Game of Thrones, the sound of the dragons when they jumping on the people and firing them. The sound of the warplane is the same exactly close to that. It's you feel the warplanes coming to you, like to destroy you, to eat you, and the people, they have to face it every day.
Well, you are yourself a Syrian. You grew up under the threat of war. You were imprisoned at one point and even tortured by the Assad regime. How did your life experience influence the way you made this film?
I've been tortured close to death in the Syrian regime prison. And the torture system in Syria, it's very close to the torture system in the time of Stalin.
Of Stalin.
Yeah, Stalin, the Soviet Union, because was inspiring by that style, as well in the North Korea, because the Assad father, Hafez al-Assad, was bringing this system to torture the people and silence the filmmaker, artist, the journalism. That's why we lose the freedom of expression. And
because you spoke out.
Exactly. I try to make a films documenting the demonstration in Syria, the civil demonstration, following a group of young people who try to change for democracy. And this experience was not easy for me also, because I was hearing a lot of sound of women who was tortured because of their gender, and it went out of the person angry and want to do something to express this situation. I'm now, as a Syrian, who I lost almost all my friend because of this is war.
So you have something to say, clearly, but you couldn't even physically get in to Eastern Al-Ghouta to film this because it was under a blockade. It was surrounded by Syrian government troops. Not only that, the hospital was dark. It was cramped. I mean, look, you're no stranger to war zones. You've made films there before, but technically speaking, how did you pull this off?
Yeah. We was shooting two teams. One team's brave team, a great cinematographer also. They was shooting in Eastern Ghouta. I was shooting in northern of Syria and other cave hospital. We managed to communicate in this way, and I sent them the footage that to see how I'm shooting in northern of Syria, and they are sending me also the footage that to show, like, to see that.
So to be clear, you had a team of cinematographers who were behind enemy lines, underground in the hospital, but you were on the other side and you were communicating back and forth with the footage that you've gathered.
Yeah, exactly, because we don't know what's going to happen with the medical team, because they was all the time under attack and under the bump, so we don't know if they will be killed. Then we couldn't do anything. So I was trying to continue documenting in the other side with other teams in northern of Syria, which is like around 60 to 80 kilometers.
And the climax of the film occurs in early 2018 during what appears to be a chemical attack. The Syrian government, of course, as you know, has long denied that it's used any illegal chemical weapons during this civil war, but you seem to capture it. pretty clearly.
Yes, exactly. We documented around 12 hours of chemical attacks that happened in 2018. Also, we documented the 2013 chemical attacks. And we try all the time. Of course, we don't have a real evidence for that, but we have the footage as evidence for the crime against the humanity and using the chemical warfare over the civilians.
After the attack, the Syrian government essentially forced the evacuation of that region. And we see Dr. Amani leaving the cave. The hospital has to be evacuated. What happened to her since? Is she safe?
Dr. Amani, she's not safe. So she's been displaced to Turkey. I follow her to Turkey and kept documented with her. Dr. Amani, she's still not safe. She's one of the person who witnessed the chemical attack. She one who know the truth closely. She one who's managed to handle a lot of witnessing on different war crimes, and she have handling all this document that she recorded all her times working in a hospital. As a first-hand responder.
And is the hospital in Al Ghouta gone?
The hospital in Ghouta is taken by Russians now, and the Syrian regime halfly destroyed, and there's a couple of tunnels is destroyed by the Syrian regime and Russia.
So this brings us to the latest chapter in the Syrian war, which we are still very closely following today. Turkey has launched an incursion into North Syria to expel the Kurds. U.S. troops are going home. The Russians are taking advantage of the power vacuum, and Assad is now reclaiming control of the border. Do you hold out any hope for peace in Syria?
I'm hopeful. This is what's make me like survive, and this is what's make me make this movie. When I meet such a person like Dr. Amani or such a people that I featured them in my previous film here, when I meet the lawyers, which is also in my next film, that working hard to rebuild Syria, I feel helpful, because this is how my mission is, bring these stories around this war to get more attentions and more empathy with these people, more understand, and more hope for myself and for the people around.
That's Faris Fayyad. His new National Geographic documentary film is The Cave, and it comes out today. Faris, thanks for making this film. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And one more note from this film. Four people on the hospital staff, including two nurses and an ambulance driver, were killed during the filming of the documentary. We'll have more information at hereandnow.org.
Some of us call it Aunt Flo, others call it our period. Whatever you call it, half the population experiences it, and yet we rarely, if ever, talk about it, let alone the financial impacts of this monthly visitor. Well, now there's a movement underway to end a sales tax on period products like tampons and pads. Jennifer Weiss-Wolf, co-founder of Period Equity, a legal organization dedicated to menstrual equity, joins us now with more. Welcome, Jennifer.
Hi, glad to be here.
First off, what does menstrual equity mean, and how does it impact our daily lives?
Menstrual equity is a frame and a phrase to capture this very essence of what it would look like to have a policy agenda that focused on engagement, participation in school, in the workplace, truly in our democracy, and how that intersects with menstruation and access to menstrual products and information about menstruation so that people can really live their healthiest, best lives.
Okay, and part of that includes how much we spend on menstrual products. California just put a pause on a sales tax of menstrual products, but that's only for 2 years. You're working to get all states to end sales tax permanently. Tell us a little bit more about that effort.
Yeah, the tampon tax. So this is a campaign that kicked off back in 2015 with a national petition that I'd put up with Cosmopolitan magazine. And has succeeded over the past 4 years in 32 states actually introducing legislation to do just that, to eliminate the sales tax on menstrual products. As you mentioned, California is one of the states that has taken action. They did so through their budget, which will last for 2 years starting at the beginning of 2020. But six other states have actually gotten it done with something that's actually really remarkable in today's politics, which is bipartisan support.
Well, some people might be saying, okay, well, we pay sales tax on lots of things. Is there a male equivalent to this? Why is this such a big deal?
Well, we do pay sales tax on lots of things, and that's true. But states are allowed to make exemptions for items that they deem to be necessary. And states have actually chosen a lot of kind of not so necessary objects or items to put in that category, ranging from barbecued sunflower seeds to gun club memberships to Mardi Gras beads. People often point to the fact that Viagra is sales tax exempt. That's because it's a prescription medication. But indeed, it's worth questioning why it was that menstrual products were almost routinely left off the table on that examination.
What do states stand to lose if they repeal these types of taxes? I mean, I can only imagine it's a great source of revenue for them.
Well, you know, it obviously depends on the population and the number of people in the state who menstruate and buy menstrual products. So it can range from $1 million in the state of Utah. It was $20 million in the state of California, which for what it's worth in terms of, you know, large state budgets is probably a drop in the bucket as far as, you know, the state's economy is concerned. But I think the broader equity and fairness question is why should that revenue be on the backs of just those who menstruate when there are items that we could choose to replace that with that are either less necessary or used equally by the whole population.
I want to bring up something that might seem far removed, but you say it's not. So last week, there was a lot of conservative criticism over Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's $80 haircut. And you've argued that it's all part of the same pink tax, as you call it, which really is the practice of charging more for products and services that target women. Talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, exactly. The pink tax is a little different. It's not a state-generated revenue. It's price gouging. But I think both are examples of you know, how the economy really is not set up to work in favor of women's interests. Everything from the wage gap to glass ceilings to the idea that women are often frequently charged more for the same items, that our needs are not considered in making sales tax policy. This all adds up to the same equation in that it costs more to be a woman in this society.
And you now argue that this tampon tax specifically is unconstitutional. What's next in this effort?
Yeah, so that is the next chapter in this advocacy. It's been a robust policy campaign, but a group of lawyers and I have gotten together to make the case that, in fact, this is sex-based discrimination and therefore unconstitutional and therefore illegal. So it's not really just a matter now of asking legislators to do the right thing, but it's bringing the force of the law to let them know that they must cease this practice.
And tomorrow happens to be period day. What can we expect next?
Well, it's amazing to see so much activism and activity and enthusiasm for an issue that was really something of an orphan issue. So I think that is just a taste of what's to come. Once people start talking about periods and menstruation, they're actually surprised to realize, one, it's not that hard to talk about, and two, that there are just a lot of seemingly neutral or quiet policies that have been not serving our interests. And if we just speak up about it, we can make positive change for all in our society and really move towards a greater model of equity and equality.
Jennifer Weiss-Wolf, she's the co-founder of Period Equity, a legal organization dedicated to what activists call menstrual equity. Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for this conversation.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.